Welcome to the MMA Roadshow episode number 58 and a half. It is bonus edition Roadshow content. UFC Fight Night 87 is in the books. The after party is just about in the books as well, as we see some of our friends drunkenly wandering by here. John Morgan struggling here. Mike Bond is with me. Cold coffee back home in Vegas, so had to take the young Mike Bond and get his thoughts on what was just a very entertaining event, I thought. Start to finish, fantastic atmosphere.
Make it sound like a second fiddle or something. No cold coffee. So
you're
not the
normal co-host. We're just keeping it real.
I'm just teasing.
No, but happy that you're here filling in. But let's talk about it, man. Just overall impressions, number one. I thought this was a great event. I thought it was very entertaining. I thought for a first event in the Netherlands, the crowd represented. They were knowledgeable, man. I felt like they were, like, cheering at the right times and very respectful. Man, I just overall, start to finish, man, I think this was a home run for the UFC.
It was. And as you said, the crowd. One thing, I talked to a few local journalists, people from Netherlands, that said, you know, I don't know. Because I asked, you know, what's it going to be like on Sunday? And they're like, I don't know. Like, I think they'll be very excited for the stand-up, but, like, I don't know what's going to happen if this goes to the ground and, like, if it stays on the ground for a super long time. And I was like, yeah, I could see that. I mean, it's a kickboxing country, all that stuff. There hasn't been any of these big MMA shows,
right,
like high-level grapplers competing in front of these people with a grapple-first strategy, stuff like that. So, but we saw pretty much from the first fight with Willie Gates and Yoka Sasaki, that was a ground fight for the most part.
Yeah.
It ended with a submission, and they were just as excited for some of the submissions. I know, like, obviously not the big knockouts by the local Dutch people, but some other finishes. They got just as hyped for that as anything else. And it was funny throughout the night. You would see, like, anytime someone got a stand, like, stood up from the ground, they cheered super loud.
They definitely like that.
Like, yeah, like, of course they want it to be standing, but it wasn't, you know, something you'd expect just any time it goes to the ground and, like, there's submission.
Like, boo right away.
Yeah, just like, boo. Like, it was fine.
I thought they cheered transitions and guard passes and all those things.
They did. They did it. You know, it was a great crowd. They were super knowledgeable. And like you said, just some of those moments I'll never forget. The walkout, Jermaine Dami.
Oh.
Like, I think I would love to go back and time that, because I think that must have been, like, one of the longest walkouts
I was told
ever.
It was 4.5 minutes.
Yeah.
So I was told it was that, 4.5 minutes.
So I wonder what they were doing, because they probably didn't show that. We're obviously in the venue. So they didn't show, like, that on the Fox broadcast, right? Did
I don't
they do
know.
Well, 4.5 straight minutes?
I don't know how, because I saw some people tweeting about it, so they must have showed some of it. Or maybe, you know, like in Brazil, like Combate, you get to see the whole thing.
Sure,
So maybe it was some people
and
that were
sometimes
looking at
that. Sometimes, like, when it's the second fighter who walks in, they'll cut in, like, kind of right at the end.
Right.
But it's usually right when they get into, like, the prep point and they're getting,
which,
you know,
they probably
Vaseline
thought she'd be in the prep point.
Sure, so, like, maybe they showed, like, the last minute, but even the beginning was the best. She walked out so slowly. It was just, you know, taking in the moment. I had chills as well.
Yeah.
She was just taking it all in. It was a great song she walked into. And, yeah, like, that was one of those moments I'll never forget. And then Stefan Struve, the next fight, was the complete opposite. He booked it to the octagon,
yeah,
like, tried to get there as fast as possible. And then Overeem's walkout is, you know, a classic at this point. He came into the Dutch anthem,
national anthem, and of course
this,
he had,
like,
his techno beats,
his random techno that, like, no one knows what it is. There's these random songs. I think some of them must be made for him, maybe, because, like, I've heard people ask him in interviews, like, what's the song you walked out to, and he won't say. It's weird. He, like, tries to keep
I've never
it
known
secret.
That that's interesting.
It's very weird. Like, yeah, it's very strange. But anyways, those moments when they were walking out, like, absolutely awesome. The crowd went wild, and those are really fun things. Like, we were in Sweden. We saw Gustafsson walk out. Like,
yeah.
I remember UFC 129 when, like, Mark Hamnick came out to I'm
Special.
Coming Home. Like,
coming Home, that
it's
was a great
awesome
one.
Like, those are great things.
These were up there. I mean, the atmosphere there was up there.
And, yeah, sorry.
No, you mentioned it. I mean, the main event, Alistair Overeem defeating Andre Arlovski. Really big. The Dutch national anthem was a nice touch, and then of course it came out to his techno dance beat. Then he got the job done, man. You could feel the crowd was. I mean, this guy is a superstar here. I mean, the kickboxing background, and it's funny, man. Just watching Alistair all week long. I mean, Alistair kind of has a reputation as being a little bit of a kind of a prickly guy to deal with or whatever. And I didn't feel that way at all this week, man. I thought he was, like, super pleasant, kind of in a good mood all week long. And I think maybe it just had to do with being here in the Netherlands and being comfortable. But I thought he was, you know, relaxed and happy and all these things all week long. And I thought his performance tonight was fantastic. It was a smart, intelligent performance in the fact that he was patient. He picked his shots, but not that patience where he's looking gun shy. You know, it was like really like he was trying to implement something and do something, not I just don't feel the rhythm. I don't feel it. And I thought it was a really good performance. And, of course, the spectacular finish, the leaping. He even called it a Karate Kid kick at the press conference. I mean, it was like a damn crane kick.
Yeah.
And then through the left hand as well. I thought it was a great performance by Alistair Overeem.
Yeah, and I saw a few people kind of criticizing it, say, like, you know, Overeem didn't look at his best tonight, but, like, he was still able to win the fight. So, like, that in its own right is impressive. It was interesting because Andre came out hard and he threw that huge flurry. And, like, I remember, I didn't know because it was kind of on the opposite side of the cage from us. I just saw, you know, Alistair covering up as best as he could.
Right.
And he took a lot, like, I don't know if some of those got through. Like, maybe he got a little, maybe one of those stung him. Like, Andre threw a lot of punches in that flurry.
He definitely knew he wasn't, like, he made sure that he was covered up. Like,
yeah,
he didn't just, like, absolutely, I'm going to get out of the way real quick. He knew he was in some trouble.
And you don't know with heavyweights. Like, that could be it. The crowd started booing right when that flurry was happening. Like, you were like, oh, shit, is this going to be, like, the worst case? All the awesome wins coming up. Like, is Alistair going to lose in the main event in, like, under a minute or something like that? But it didn't end up going that way. He covered up. He got out of it. You know, it was smart and precise from that point. And it was one of those things that I talked to him before the fight, like, you know, if you kind of change your style, you seem like in the first round you're being a lot more patient and methodical. I don't know if after tonight's performance he still has the highest striking accuracy rate in UFC history, but he did coming in. So, and that was something I talked to him about, and, like, you know, he's kind of adapted his style. We saw earlier, like, when he was you know, in Dream and stuff, and just he would go in and he would blitz you,
right?
And, like, he was getting knockouts, like Todd Duffy knocked him out in like 20 seconds,
right?
Like, he, you know, he'd be that guy. And now he's had to change his style. Maybe it's because of how some of the UFC fights have gone for him. We've seen you know, him slim down a bit, and maybe people have other theories, but I think that's, I don't know personally from talking to him, but I would think that's a conscious decision,
because
we've
so.
Seen him gas out. We saw the Bigfoot fight. Like, he was absolutely owning him in that fight, and then he just looked exhausted going to that
third round.
He
has to pace himself.
Yeah,
and I think today he knew that he was – and this was – because I picked Overeem coming in, but all week long – because first of all, you think of Overeem as this massive dude. You kind of forget how big Andre is. And they stood next to each other. I'm like, I think Andre's bigger. I'm like, this is great. And then – just the speed and athleticism that Andre brings to the table. Like, yes, there's the chin issues that everybody talks about, but, you know, as you've pointed out in stats and stuff, I mean, Overeem's been knocked out.
Yeah,
as
11
many times,
and
more actually
more
than Andre.
Between kickboxing and MMA, yeah.
So, you know, so I thought, well, maybe I'm overstating that chin issue. And then again, I started thinking about the athleticism. And I was like, man, maybe this is one I need to waffle on a little bit and pick. You know, it's like we're kind of giving Alistair the home field advantage, but he flew in the same day we did. We saw him in the damn airport.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, he had the home field as far as this is his country.
Yeah.
But not, I mean, he still had the flight.
Yeah,
he
still
had to deal with all
the time change.
Things.
Yeah, same stuff
on
there.
So I started thinking, like, maybe I need to change it. And I was like, no, I'm going to, you know what, all those things are. And then the whole thing about the split of the camp and the you know, the base guys, the key guys being with Andre, stuck with Alistair, and obviously it paid off. And I thought it was a really good performance. I did want to talk about quickly the stoppage, because I remember I mentioned to you right when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned you saw online that some people were criticizing Mark Goddard for being a late stoppage. I kind of had a feeling that was going to be the case. I hadn't seen a lot of it, but as soon as it happened, I was like, dude, he's going to get criticized. But I will say this, and I wanted to talk to Mark about it tonight and just didn't get a chance to run into him, but I think the stoppage was good. It was right in front of us. So just the angle that we had, we could actually see Andre's face, and we could see the exposed side because he was turned over on his left side. And it was turned and when Alistair hurt him, he was definitely hurt, but when he jumped on top, like, the first four or five punches he threw basically just hit the shoulder. They didn't land at all. And so I think a lot of people on TV probably thought that they were all getting through. They weren't. Now, the last couple did get in. I think at that point, Mark realized, like, Andre's not getting up from this.
Yeah, and he started to shell up, and, like, we saw the reactions out of him. And either way, like, Alistair was in a position he would have kept doing that forever.
Oh,
like, even if he kept blocking it. Like, that was a position Andre wasn't getting out of there. Like, and we haven't really seen, I guess aside from the Travis Brown fight, like, out of all of Andre's fights, when he gets hurt bad, like, that's more often than not the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I wasn't really expecting him to get out of that position. So I thought it was a fine stoppage. Like you said, not all those things got through, but he was hurt bad. Like, he didn't pop up right after.
He wasn't. No complaints.
Yeah, he shelled up. He was hurt. We saw him at the press conference. He had some, you know, nicks and knacks on his face and whatnot. But, yeah, just like we said, a really good performance by Alistair. And one thing that I am a little bummed we didn't get to ask about at the press conference, and I just didn't have a chance. I was working on some stuff and didn't get the mic. I'd just like to know where this ranks, like, you know, among the greatest moments of his career. Because he's done a lot of stuff, Strikeforce title, K-1 title, all this stuff. But, like, you know, even though it's just like a contender's fight, this was, you know, a moment I'm sure he's been dreaming about his entire life. Like, he probably didn't think, you know, the UFC is going to come to my home country. I could be the main event, like, all this kind of stuff. And now he's already trying to look to the future. He wants to talk about defending the title in the Netherlands or in Amsterdam next year. And now I know, like, if the UFC is planning to go there, I mean, I imagine with the way tonight went, they'll be back for sure at some point in the Netherlands. I don't know if it'll be Rotterdam again or Amsterdam, but or you know elsewhere. But still, a great moment for Alistair's career. I'm sure if you asked him, he would maybe say the greatest. In my opinion, like if it was me, it would probably be a moment I'd never forget.
Some big accomplishments, but I bet it ranked up there. And you're right. I think they definitely want to go to Amsterdam at some point. We heard that some officials from the Amsterdam Arena were going to be in attendance. You got to think they enjoyed what they saw. You know, there were concerns. And you know, Giovanni Chin talked about it earlier in the week, and I talked to some people off record as well. Like, bottom line is, like, the sport had kind of been associated with gangsters, basically.
Yeah.
And there was some concern. I think probably everybody saw at UFC Fight 97 was like, no, this is a legitimate sport. This is a legitimate business. Everything's being done the right way here.
Yeah.
And you can't help but see. I saw, you know, obviously a sold-out building. I saw a lot of empty beer cups laying around, so I'm sure there were a lot of concessions sold, and everybody's having a good time. And then, of course, you know, everybody leaves with this great feeling. The three Dutch fighters pick up victories. You got to think that the people in Amsterdam are going to be thinking, you know, maybe we can get in that business too.
Yeah, it would make all the sense in the world. This seems like a really great market. The people seem knowledgeable. It was, you know, very exciting. I ended up even talking, I don't know how it came, but I had a brief chat with one of the security guys who was in the venue, and I even said, like,
Security,
you know,
pulled you over, huh?
No, just like,
I don't know how it happened. We just started chatting.
No, I was actually having a cigarette, if you must know.
Oh, okay.
Owning myself as a smoker here. That's not what I was trying to do, but it's all good. And I just asked him, I said, you know, what was the crowd like tonight? Like compared to some other events, he's like, oh, like usually, like I do a lot of soccer matches and stuff. People are like going, they go there for like to drink, and then kind of the game is secondary. Tonight, like they were there for the entertainment. He's like, I don't think there was one fight in the crowd, like anything like that. They were all there for the fights, and they enjoyed it. And you know, it seemed like a really great place for the UFC to come back at some point. Like,
that's awesome.
A really good market. So.
Well, Alistair afterwards said, listen, and he said it going into the fight too, but he said it afterwards, I'm going to be fighting for the heavyweight title next against the winner of UFC 198 fight between Fabrice Verdum and Stipe Miocic. He said it's going to be at 205 in Madison Square Garden. Sounded like he knew something we didn't. I did reach out to UFC officials and say, hey, listen, what can you tell me? Is this the real deal or not? And they did say, yes, we basically consider Alistair number one contender. Now, it's the UFC. Mm-hmm. Anything can change. Nothing is promised until that contract is signed. But probably does make sense that he's the number one contender next.
Sure.
But what they did tell me was that we're not currently targeting that fight for Madison Square Garden. Not to say that, again, not anything can happen.
Well,
the thing is,
it's a brilliant move by Alistair.
Right.
Everyone wants to be on the New York card.
Right.
So for him to say, just put it out there in advance, say, like, I want to fight on that card, like, it might not happen, but at least he's putting it out there. You know, it would work out timing-wise if it were to come together. And it's just, you know, it's a smart move. If he doesn't get his way, no big deal. But to just propose it, all the headlines, and, you know, Alistair Overeem wants the title shot, UFC 205, it just makes sense. So I thought that was a very wise move for him to do that. But for sure he's the number one contender, unless we see that fight next week between Miocic and Werdum, like, end in a draw or like some crazy freak ending, like a, you know, Vitor Belfort, Randy Couture, like Isle.
Oh, it's true.
Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
just
yeah.
like something ridiculous, which
don't jinx it.
I'm not trying to, because I wouldn't want that show with 45,000 Brazilians to end like that. That would be a damn shame. But barring some freak occurrence, which, you know, it doesn't often happen in heavyweight title fights. Usually it's a pretty definitive ending. I don't really see that going five rounds. So I think we get a clear winner out of that fight, and Overeem fights the winner. It's like, it's very simple to me. I can't really think of anyone else who deserves the title shot. I know JDS looked great, but Overeem just knocked him out. So
yeah, he's got the argument. All right, I completely agree with you there. Well, our man Simon Head is emerged from the after party and taking a seat next to us. So let's chat at him real quick and see what he's up to. And while we get all set and taking care of these frosty beverages and all that, let's hear from Alistair Overeem, and also let's briefly hear from Andrei Arlovski, who, it should be said, was probably as bummed as could be, but actually showed up to the press conference and did show his face, which I'm sure wasn't a lot of fun. So let's hear from the two men that were involved in the main event.
Esther, could you tell us, in your mind, what percentage you're certain of getting your next fight as a title fight? And secondly, sir, tell us who would be your ideal matchup in that fight.
Well, I do think I have the best cards for a title win. I'm not going to call it title shot, title win. You know, I really believe may the best man win. I have a history with Verdum. I think he's a very tricky, very clever fighter. You know, Stipe is also very dangerous. But may the best man win. I consider myself a champion. Champions fight anybody. Anybody, anytime, anywhere. So may the best man win. And I think I do have the best cards for the next title win.
Any words exchanged with Arlovski afterwards? And if so, what was said?
Not a lot of words, but there was a handshake, there was respect. We looked each other in the eyes. Obviously, this was not a good moment. The whole thing was not good for the team, but I've done the best I could to keep the energy positive. Not to disrupt anybody. Keep the whole vibe positive. And I think, you know, the respect is there. The respect is there. It's not gonna be gone. I mean, we're always going to see each other in the gym. For me, there's no bad vibes.
And what was the strategy going in there, obviously, against your team?
Well, we know he has very dangerous hands. He's got a very dangerous acceleration. He's tough, you know. He's a fighter. He's a former champ. He has a lot of experience, fought a lot of top guys. So definitely we pick your shots. Don't be too hasty. Of course, we are fighting at home, so, you know, maybe there's crowd pressure. Just be relaxed. Just do your thing. Be in the moment. Be with the flow. And, you know, I'm in a very good shape at the moment, in a very peak shape. And if I'm flowing, then I do a lot of damage. And that was just the main thing. Just be in your flow and the finish or the domination or whatever, it will come automatic.
Just to follow up quickly with Alistair, I know you said all along you were trying to keep it positive, but you admitted there was some tension. I mean, do you feel like, can you go back to the gym? And do you have any regrets over just the way this whole thing played out?
I have no regrets. You know, I reiterate, it would be stupid to think. I mean, Andrei Arlovski, great fighter, he's top 10. He's hunting for the title, I'm top 10. There's not that many heavyweights out there. So it would be stupid to think we would not face each other at some point. On the other note, I mean, we're not training together. We're not sparring together. We're not buddies. We don't hang out. So, to me, I don't have any, I think, you know, I have a great relationship with the coaches. We spoke out to each other that we're going to pick up where we left off right after this fight. And, I expect to be back in the gym in no time because got to make ready for the big one, of course. So I'll be back there. And, I tried my best to keep everything positive. And, do what you can.
Thanks, Alistair. Just Andre, I know still fresh right now, rough night, but it did seem like a decent performance until you got caught. Can you talk about how you felt and did this whole tension beforehand affect you in this fight?
Of course, I'm disappointed, but Alistair, he's a great fighter, no doubt, and tonight it was his night, and I'm going to come back in the gym and we're going to do homework. I still have a great coach in the MMA business, so we have a lot of work to do.
All right, so my man Simon Head has sat down with us. Again, he's emerged from the depths of the after party that's been going on for hours and hours and hours this evening. I will say that you have emerged much better off than some other people that I have seen in the past few minutes or so.
Absolutely. Partly because I have a certain tolerance level that perhaps some of the other MMA media don't have, but also because I've been very sensible. I've got a flight tomorrow and I actually need to get some work done before then. So, it's
pace
all good.
Pace yourself a little bit. Good stuff, man. Well,
yeah.
Again, we talked briefly about the main event. I think it was an impressive performance. I think the other thing, too, is I think everybody here is just ready to be done with it, man. I know that Alistair the whole time was trying to say that, listen, this is just business. It's nothing personal. It's all that. But, I mean, I can tell you just from what I observed this week that everybody that was involved in this fight in the Jackson Wink MMA camp was bothered. And I don't want to say that they think right or wrong, it was just a difficult position for them. I think he made a great point at the post-fight press conference. You do have to be prepared to fight anybody in the division if you're going to be a champion. And in some ways, you might say it's refreshing that a guy that's technically a teammate would say, I'll fight him. You know, this is just a business. But I think all week long and even tonight, as everything, the emotions kind of started bubbling out of people after they'd had a cocktail or two, I think this was a hard week for everybody involved in this fight.
It really was. It was kind of tricky. I mean, someone made a really good point in a press conference where the whole kickboxing thing, and this is where Alistair has been a part of that, and he obviously came through that, and the whole thing about fighting teammates is something, it's just an occupational hazard. And in kickboxing in particular, and particularly in K1 with the Grand Prix format, you've got that tournament structure where you may well have more than one guy from one team in that tournament bracket. And eventually, if they're both successful, they will meet at some point. And when Overeem won the K1 kickboxing Grand Prix, he beat two teammates. He beat Tyron Spong, and then he beat Gökhan Saki. And I remember watching it, and you can watch it on the Ream documentary, mm-hmm. which is one of the best pieces of web content you can get in MMA. You can go back and check that out. It's on Vimeo. There was a situation where he fought Gökhan Saki in a semi-final. And Cor Hemmers, who was the manager of Golden Glory back then, who were looking after both Saki and Overeem, he went into both dressing rooms and he basically said, I love you both, I'm going to step back from this. You go in there, do what you need to do. I love you both. Whoever wins, wins. We move on. And that was basically how it was. And I think there's a certain sort of nobility to that, and it worked quite kind of well. And it's something that we don't see very much in MMA, and particularly when it comes to the Greg Jackson gym, we do see that reluctance to fight teammates. And Alistair is a very independent athlete. He's trained at a lot of different training camps. He's moved around the world. He's trained in Thailand. He's trained in Holland. He's trained in the US. He's trained all over the place. He's a bit nomadic in that respect. So for him, it's probably less of an issue. But for the guys who are more deeply entrenched in the whole American way of training in mixed martial arts, maybe it is a little bit more of a problem. The fight happened. Both guys, I thought, conducted themselves really well during fight week. And when the fight happened, obviously, we now have a winner. It was Alistair Overeem. He did it very decisively, and he moves on. The interesting story now is what happens next with Jackson Winklejohn. How well integrated will he be back? Is he going to be just...
He said, I'm back in, no big deal.
Well, he thinks he's fine. It's unrealistic to think that there isn't going to be a little bit of weirdness. Tension might be overdoing it, but it's going to be a bit icky, is probably the phrase, when he gets back there, where you've got a guy who, you know, most of the big hitters from the coaching staff are in the other corner.
Right.
And Overeem went and won that fight, and he won it decisively and spectacularly and all the rest of it. So, we're all big boys in this sport, and everyone's grown up in this, and you'd like to think that everything can move on and crack on from there. But it is an interesting new dynamic in terms of MMA at the elite level. Kickboxing, it's kind of an accepted thing. So, it's an interesting side story to... the whole heavyweight championship picture, and we do now have a legit new number one contender now, I think, in the heavyweight division. I think he is the guy who stands over and above everybody else.
Yep.
Now.
I agree. Well, let's talk about the co-main event. Stefan Struve picked up a big win for him over Antonio Bigfoot Silva. Obviously, a much-needed win for all that he's gone through. And, of course, a special night for him, being a Dutch native as well. It meant a lot to him. Has a home about 30 minutes from here. From what we were told, it's about halfway between Rotterdam and Amsterdam, basically. So this is a bit of a home game, even more so than just his native country. Got it done in 16 seconds. Not a lot to talk about in terms of breaking things down. And I hate to take away from Stefan Struve, because it was obvious, and he said, like, we knew Bigfoot was coming at us. And you could tell he was ready for it, because, you know, he was punching, he was trying to use that length. He knew that Bigfoot was going to try to get inside, and he threw that right hand, and the right hand, I think, had Bigfoot rocked already.
Yep.
He kind of tumbled forward, tried to turn it into a takedown. Stefan Struve sprawled, delivered a barrage of elbows, fight's over, 16 seconds. And I say all this to say that, again, I don't want to take away from Stefan Struve, but that right hand, to me, when I watch it, it looked grazing at best. And this is a man that stood in there and went toe-to-toe with Mark Hunt. And it just – I don't know. I mean, I people point to, well, is it testosterone? I mean, I don't know. I don't know if testosterone does something for your, quote-unquote, chin. You know, I don't know. But, man, just a tough result if you're Bigfoot Silva.
Absolutely. I mean, there are a whole load of potential factors involved. First of all, we had two heavyweights here who probably had to cut weight to make heavyweight. Struve was bang on 265.
Right.
Bigfoot was 266. That leads you to think that they probably had to cut weight for that. So they may be somewhat dehydrated. Any fighter who is in any way dehydrated, even if it's by a few percent, that has a massive effect on their punch retention and being able to actually absorb punishment to the head. Because your brain basically sits in a pool of water. And if you haven't got enough water in there, your protection from basically the brain banging the sides of the head. And that's what causes you to get rocked and knocked out. That's the very simple mechanics of a concussion, right? I'm not a sort of physiologist.
Well explained.
That's not a physiologist, but that is...
That's a pretty simple explanation. In
very basic terms, that is what it is, right? So, but the other thing with Bigfoot, and I had this discussion downstairs, you know, as you say, I've come from the after party and I've spoken to loads of people, and Bigfoot Sybil's been knocked out quickly a few times now. I'm not someone to turn around and say you should quit the sport, because I'm just a guy who writes about
the
sport.
It's not your place to retire anybody.
I'm just a guy who writes about the sport. And, you know, you look at Bigfoot's record and you know, he's 7 fights. He's won 1 out of his last 7,
yep.
Right? There's a draw chucked in there, which was... The fight with Mark Hunt.
Sure.
But he's lost a lot of fights, and they've all been by TKO or KO. And yes, we write about the sport, and yes, we love to see knockouts because they are the most spectacular element of the sport, and they're the wow factor. But what we don't want, and it is kind of it's a bit of a contradiction, we don't want to see the same guy getting starched on a regular basis. And this is a guy who, and you mentioned the testosterone thing, he clearly does have an issue there where he needs some sort of medication in order to, I think it's the pituitary gland.
Pituitary gland. Right. He's one of the few people that really does seem to have a legitimate reason.
Right. And you know, there are medical things there, but this is a guy who, notwithstanding that, has been knocked out a few times. And I think we're getting very close to the point where you either say to him, you need to take a significant drop in competition, or you need to talk about walking away from the sport. And it's very hard when you start having these conversations about someone basically walking away from their livelihood.
That's right.
It's very difficult. And this is
not
a guy,
many things you can jump in quite as lucrative.
Absolutely. And this is a guy who, let's not forget, beat the great Fedor Emelianenko.
Yeah.
This was a shadow of that guy. And we don't like to see that. And you can talk about it from an aesthetic point of view and you think, oh, but he was this good then and now he's not. Really, that doesn't matter. And, you know, we're very lucky that we get to cover this sport and we're very close to it and we see the reactions and everything about these athletes. These are human beings at the end of the day and we need to make sure that they're okay. And you do begin to worry about Bigfoot Silver. And honestly, when he lost that fight that quickly, you do start to think, is it maybe time that someone takes into one side and says, we need to look after you, Antonio. We need to take you out of this now. I think that's possibly the thing that's the stage we're at right now. It's a tough one, but I think that's where we are right now with him.
All right, we'll jump out of order a little bit with the card because I did want to kind of wrap up the Dutch fighters. Jermaine Di Rendami, a great performance. I mean, I hate to say, I don't mean to demean or belittle her opponent or anything, but just the, you know, props to her for stepping in. But just the size difference between them was incredible. I think we all knew going in that could be a rough night, but not so much about the performance. It was a great performance. I just wanted to talk about the atmosphere. To me, that was a moment that I'll never forget. I had chills as she came in. It was just an amazing moment, and I thought it really was something special and kind of set the tone for that back end of the card. You know, we had some prelims. We had a lot of fun. It was very entertaining, but really set the tone for the Dutch heavy hitters to come in. And I thought it was just amazing to see the type of support that she had because, you know, I think Jermaine Di Rendami, well-respected, but definitely not a star in the United States or anywhere else, but she was given the superstar treatment.
Absolutely, and I think the thing with this is there were 3 Dutch fighters on the card. MMA fans would be far more aware of Alistair Overeem and Stefan Struve than they would be of Jermaine Di Rendami. However, Jermaine Di Rendami, most recently of the 3, has come through the whole kickboxing scene. And that really is the whole, in terms of combat sports, that's something that the Dutch fight fans are most familiar with. So perhaps there's a little bit more of a connection there because of that. And if you look at the 3 fighters on the night, the Ream had a great walk-in. It was a fantastic walk-in. Stefan Struve had a good walk-in. But I think in terms of the crowd reaction, Jermaine Durandamy maybe topped the three of them.
I agree.
And I think that was certainly something worthy of note. And the reaction. She's also got a very interesting backstory and you know, the whole thing about her getting into this and her relationship with Anna Elmos during fight week has been very interesting, because quite often you get fighters who they, you know, there's a simmering rivalry and all the rest of it. They were like best buddies all week. You know, they were hugging at the weigh-ins. I was here in the lobby. We're sat in the lobby here in the Fighter Hotel right now, and sat about 10 yards from where we're sitting are a few sort of cushions and sofas and things. And Jermaine Durandamy was sat there with her team, and Anna Elmos walked in through the front door. Jermaine saw her, and they immediately went to one another and embraced.
That's cool.
The first interaction probably between the two of them in Fight Week. And I was here with a couple of UK journalists, and we went, look at that. Isn't that just like the best thing about this sport? And it carried on through the whole thing, except for the period in the Octagon where they beat seven shades out of each other. and that's the sport. There's the business element. But Jermaine's performance was fantastic. The ovation that she received was, she was the homecoming queen of UFC Rotterdam. It really was. And it was great to see. And the other great thing about it, from a media point of view, I always look at storytelling and I look at carrying things on and how things might progress in the future. Jermaine was very articulate, and she basically poured her heart out to the fans, and things like that really count for something, because the next time she's on a card, whether you're a Dutch fan or if you're an English fan or if you're an American fan, and you see her name on a fight card, you'll think that's the girl who had 10,500 people cheering her name in Rotterdam a few months back. And you know, we know that she was offered the fight with Cyborg next weekend, and she turned that fight down. And idiot MMA fans who don't understand things will say, oh, she's ducking her. Her decision was based entirely on credibility, based entirely on emotion, and entirely on the fact that she wanted to win the fight in front of her home fans.
This opportunity meant a lot to her.
Do you know what I mean? And that was the thing. And for me, if you looked at the entire fight card, she might be the whole, you know, she might be the biggest success story of this entire fight card.
So you bring a great point that I did want to touch on, because I fully support her decision not to turn down that fight. This was a special opportunity. She doesn't know if they're ever coming back. What, you know, this was, as we knew, kind of a temperamental market. What if they find out, hey, man, it wasn't well-received, they're never coming back, and you skipped out on that opportunity? But, you know, I did ask her at the post-fight press conference, are you still interested in that fight? And I thought it was interesting that the take that I got from her was that she doesn't really care about it because she wants the bantamweight title fight. Now, you could make the argument she doesn't really care about it because who the hell really wants to fight Cyborg?
Yep.
But what I would say is, I think if you take that fight, even if it's at 140 pounds, and you somehow win that fight. Now, again, we're assuming Cyborg wins at UFC 198, and we're assuming that she looks impressive, which she tends to look impressive, that you could beat her at 140 and still get yourself a title shot at 135. Like, I think that's a more valuable victory than really just about anything else in the division right now, save for maybe, like, knocking out Holly Holm or something like that. Like, if you went in there and just, like, floored Holly Holm, then you could be like, dude, I'm the number one contender, you know? But winning that fight at 140 pounds, I don't think is a bad thing at all.
Absolutely not. And the thing with that fight was she looked fantastic in the stand-up. And there is a stylistic aesthetic to her getting in there with Chris Cyborg.
Mm.
And I understand where she's going with this, and you know, the fact that she wants to win the belt. At the end of the day, people get into this sport because they want to be the best in the world, and the standard for that is a championship belt. And in the UFC right now, it's the women's bantamweight title. You know, there isn't a 140-pound title or a 145-pound title. So I understand where she's coming from, but by the same token, the Chris Cyborg fight is would give, if she beats Chris Cyborg, can you imagine how high her stock's going to rise?
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And while you were talking to me, and I've been doing it while I've been talking to you, so that's probably why I sound a bit funny, is I'll say, okay,
more, I wasn't paying attention to you.
More funny than usual. Is I saw a tweet from Dan Hardy. Dan Hardy, great fighter and a brilliant analyst of the game, and someone who is thankfully getting more and more respect for the work that he does. He's a guy, he's a student of the game, and he really does immerse himself in this sport. He tweeted after that fight, very, very short tweet, saying, "I reckon she would take Cyborg out." Yeah. Now, that's a huge call from Dan Hardy.
That's high praise.
That's a huge call. And that immediately starts a talking point. He's like, could she? Could she do it? If Cyborg wants to stand up for three rounds, I think that's a fantastic contest. But we also know that Cyborg is more than capable of taking people to the floor and finishing them down there as well. Whereas Durandamy is basically a kickboxer who's learning MMA. Her kickboxing is on point. And if it's a stand-up fight, then I think that would be fantastic to watch. I think Durandamy versus Holly Holm would be a very interesting fight to watch. You know, so...
Although Holly's booked, so let's take her out of the equation.
Absolutely. Now. I mean, looking further down the line, I think that would be stylistically a good one. But I do think what we have here is someone who, if matched well and marketed well, could be a bit of a star for this part of the world. And we saw from the reaction, you know, arguably she got a bigger reaction than Overeem, bigger reaction than Struve. I understand where she wants to go with her career. She wants to be the best in the world. She wants a championship belt. Because at the end of the day, when you retire, you can say, yeah, I beat person X, person Y, person Z. But they say, I've got a championship belt.
Absolutely.
Here. Do you know what I mean?
No,
and that's
agree.
The difference.
And I can't... So you're right. I can't hate that point of view. I mean, it is a good point of view, but I just can't think of a bigger fight that would escalate her quicker to guarantee herself
absolutely.
A shot. So I don't know. Again, it was a special moment. I'm sure she was on cloud nine and not thinking about whatever. I mean, hopefully Sean Shelby, UFC matchmaker, will maybe get in her ear a little bit. And, of course, we've got the small fact that Cyborg has to fight at UFC 198. And I don't want to take away from Leslie Smith. I mean, listen, I'll be honest. I don't pick anybody in the world against Cyborg. I think she's incredible. So it's no insult to Leslie Smith, and I think kudos to her for stepping in. And she used the exact words when, you know, she's like, there is no bigger fight other than a title fight than this fight. So hell yeah, I jumped at the opportunity. So I don't know, we'll see what happens, but I would love to see the attitude change a little bit, because I think that could be big for her. So all right, well, Simon, I appreciate stopping by. I see my man Abby Subban is finally done working as well, so let's reset here and bring him in for just a moment or two. And while we do that, let's let you hear a little bit from the three Dutch fighters who were victorious tonight. Of course, we talked about Alistair Overeem, Stefan Struve, and Jermaine Durandamy, as they talk about what their experience was like fighting at an incredible card and incredible atmosphere at UFC Fight Night 87.
Giovanni Chin, Epic MMA. And first of all, James, thank you for coming to the Netherlands, finally, and congratulations to all fighters here. First question, actually, for all Dutch fighters, do you have a special message for the Dutch fans?
Well, a lot more coming. I mean, I still got a couple of years left. I feel like I'm becoming the old guy in the sport, but more is coming. And, you know, I already see a lot of K1 strikers making the crossover. After this, I expect a lot more to come, and there's going to be a whole new wave of Dutch fighters, and you know, that's good for Dutch MMA.
I think we need to bring in some wrestlers from overseas to work with the kickboxers. I think if they get that done, then MMA is going to be huge here. And for the crowd, this was absolutely amazing. Like, we are, what's the word? Dutch crowds are different, you know, like, and what Alistair said, I didn't know what to expect, and this was absolutely insane.
I just want to thank the Dutch crowd for all their love and support, and they made me, and I think all the Dutch fighters feel like true champions. Thank you, Holland.
That was the celebratory Dutch fighters who had themselves an incredible night here in Rotterdam. Brought in my man, Abby Subban. He's got limited time with us, but I had to bring him in. This dude is so hardcore. He is straight-up MMA junkie that as soon as we finish, you haven't slept yet, and you actually have to go get on a plane, fly back to London, and then go to work for the day.
Yep.
Your full-time gig.
Yeah. So if you look at my schedule, I fly from here at 7. I land UK time at 7. I got an hour and a half train journey, and then I start work at 8:30, and I got to sit in my office till 5.
God bless it, dude. This glamorous life that we live is a little bit tough to deal with sometimes, but it's still fun. It was a great night tonight. I want to talk about some of the prelims with you just real quickly, man. A couple standout performances. Number one, Josh Emmett picking up John Tuck, UFC newcomer, coming in and basically just looking incredible. I mean, incredibly relaxed. Looks like the real deal, undefeated. Of course, all his coaches at Team Alpha Male say he's real. As a matter of fact, there he is walking in the door right now with some wrap around his left hand, because the story of the fight was not only his fantastic performance, but this hand that just got severely mangled in the third and final round, his bone sticking out from the finger itself. So give me an idea, Abby, backstage, what was the feeling back there?
From what I could see was, I kept looking up at the screen, and every time I was doing the post fights videos, but from what I could see, he was every time I looked up, I could see him loading up on his punches, and then in between rounds, he wasn't even breathing heavy. So that's cardio for days.
Incredible.
Cardio for days. That's what I saw, and then it wasn't until I looked on Twitter and I saw our photographer's picture of the actual bone coming through. You can check that picture out on Junkie. That'll be up in one of our censored articles.
Absolutely.
It wasn't pretty, bro. And from what you told me, it wasn't even a break.
Yeah, so this is incredible. So I ran into to Danny Castillo and Justin Buchholz a little bit earlier and did want to give that update. As I said, we actually just saw Mr. Emmett walk by. He's got his hand wrapped up. But from what I'm told, there was no break. There was one kick dislocated the finger, and then a second kick basically pushed it so far in the dislocation that the bone stuck through. But there was no break at all. The bone was just not where it was supposed to be and sticking through. So he goes back to the back, and it was funny because Justin Buchholz said that this guy, Josh, he does everything that he's told to do. He's like, it's like playing a video game. You know, he responds to everything. And he's like, they were calling for him to throw the left hand in the third and final round. And he basically looked over at Justin Buchholz and was kind of like, showed him the hand. And, like, you know, they're like, okay, never mind.
Don't worry about it.
But amazingly, nothing broken. Backstage, they popped it back into place, sewed everything up, and they're telling him he can resume training probably in 10 days.
Nice. Yeah. Because he was impressive. I liked what I saw. It wasn't much because I was looking at my laptop, but every time I looked up, I could see, you know, just some power punches being thrown.
Definitely. Right. No, he looks like the real deal to me. I think he's going to be a bright prospect. I'm glad to see that he's not going to be out for – I'm assuming, you know, a break like that would, you know, months. And now we're talking about a matter of days. So that's fantastic. Rezmadadi, a favorite of the MMA Roadshow. He's always been good to us. Love his stare downs. Just crazy. I know he's certainly been a controversial figure in mixed martial arts. Of course, he was in jail for a little bit. So, you know, he's definitely gone through some stuff. Picking up a win over Jan Cabral, I did want to ask you about this, number one, because Reza is it was not his best performance. He was struggling a little bit against Jan Cabral, but I think showed some heart and some character by getting the finish late and a bizarre finish too, where he was, you know, Jan Cabral was knocked out on his feet. But I did kind of want to get your take, because you were back there filming what seemed to be a pretty emotional post-fight scrum with you guys back there in the back. Just kind of get your take on that, and then also to hear how you got him to sing again. We found out this man has a penchant for singing.
He likes to sing in front of me, man. Now, when I saw, from what I could see, he was emotional when he came in, and I said to him, bro, you're going to sing for us again? And that kind of lightened him up, and that's exactly what he did. I think it was Luis from MMA Crazy asked him a question, and he just says, no, it was something, I'm paraphrasing, but she was like, you know, you seem emotional, and tell us about tell us about your win and how it was for you. And he was like, you can't even ask me that question. It was just, and then he burst into R. Kelly's I Believe I Can Fly. but he was emotional. I mean, he talked about, you know, the stuff that he's been through and how he felt the pressure of his last fight against Norman Park, which he lost. And yeah, but he was talking, I mean, if you watched his documentary, he was talking about, like, you know, retiring just after that loss. He was just like, I don't know what to do. Let's just, you know, but that was a different Reza this time around. He was like, nah, retirement talk is out of the question at the moment, so we'll see where it goes. But he was quite critical of his performance. He knew it wasn't his best performance, and we've got to wait and see, and we'll see. From what I see with Reza, I mean, he hasn't performed well in the last two matches. Well, he lost the last one, and this one, he didn't come across as you know, a world beater, you know.
Right.
And it was just a matter of time. It was like his Jan Kovbora was gassing out, and like his legs were giving out on him, and that's what he says. He sensed that, and he just went in for the kill.
Yeah, it's interesting because Reza. The intensity that he brings, I mean, that Mad Dog nickname he's definitely earned, and you know, the weigh-ins, and he paces, and he, you know, that's a guy that's supposedly his buddy, and they're up in there, like, you know, about to scrap at the weigh-ins, whatever, but it's not translating to the cage right away. You'd like to see that intensity come through. And I don't know if it's that he's trying to pace himself to make sure that he's not the guy that ends up gassing out, but, you know, you think about the Norman Park fight, I mean, how excited everybody was for it, and then it just fell flat, you know, and this one, all credit to him, man. Jan Cabral is no joke on the ground, right, and he had him in some serious trouble. And for him to be able to battle through that, I think was very impressive, to say the least. But, you know, if he's going to take it to that next level, I think that intensity has got to translate to the cage.
One thing he did say was that, you know, he has a lot of nervous energy before. I'm sure a lot of fighters do. But he says it's like overwhelming to the point that he feels weak. So it's a giant adrenaline dump. Must be. Well, by the time he gets in the cage, before, like, the match starts or something, you know, the fight starts. And I think that's probably what it is. He needs to learn. He needs to take a page out of Overeem's book and just learn how to relax. Maybe just spend some time in the pool. And
play a little FIFA.
Play a little FIFA.
2014 World Cup's edition. That's the one you got to go with. Kyoji Horiguchi looked fantastic. You know, it's funny. This is a kid that, you know, seeing his first UFC fights, I thought, this is going to be somebody that gives Demetrius Johnson trouble someday. But he got kind of rushed into it, no doubt about that. And, you know, I mean, listen, as I will happily tell you, you know, Demetrius Johnson's the number one pound-for-pound fighter on the planet. So, you know, to put a guy in there with it, it's very, very tough. But Kyoji Horiguchi looked phenomenal, and I think he can challenge for the belt again at some time. Just the speed that he has, the unpredictability that he has, just incredible. Neil Siri, all heart in that fight, man. I got nothing bad to say about that kid. Well, kid, he's my age, but we'll see him back in there, you know. Definitely a gutsy performance by him. Did want to ask you about Leon Edwards. I thought he had the best performance of his career, to be honest with you. Looked phenomenal, just absolutely dominated Dominic Waters. And I just wonder kind of what you think about it. I mean, Jamaican-born, but calls London home now. He's one of you guys. He's one of the Brits now, I guess.
I'm a big fan of Rocky. From when he first came in, it was like he was like a knockout artist. We're just thinking, he's just going to knock people out. Then he had that loss, and I mean, I think the UFC were trying to get behind him, but then he suffered that loss, and now he's back on the fight past prelims. But from what I can see, he's got a bright future ahead of him. At one point, Dominic Waters picked him up and threw him on the floor, mm-hmm. and then next thing you know, he was on top, and it remained that way for most of the match, from what I could see, because I was looking at my laptop. But I was waiting for him to come backstage, but you know, one of the PR staff said he's not coming back, and it looked from what it looked like was a fractured orbital. Right. So we'll catch up with him again.
Yeah, he does. That fight right there showed a lot of promise. I mean, obviously England's looking for stars, and I'm sure they can adopt him as one of their own. Speaking of broken orbitals, just a second ago, I had a chance to talk to some folks a little bit around the corner. And Heather Jo Clark is actually, as we tape this in the wee hours of the morning, she's actually still at the hospital. Apparently, she suffered a broken orbital and a broken nose in that battle with Karolina Kowalkiewicz, which Karolina looked fantastic in that fight. But Heather Jo was, all heart there, too, as well.
Heather Jo can take punishment. That's from what, you know, great. I thought it was a great fight. I actually got to watch that one because I can't remember who.
You weren't working hard enough then.
Yeah. All right. But yeah, I actually saw that one, and when Karolina came back, you know, because she's Polish, everyone was asking her about Joanna, and she's actually fought Joanna before as
amateur. As an amateur, right?
Yeah. So what she did say was, she was like, "Yeah, I'd love to fight her again and get that one back," but the way she said, she didn't know how to say how she lost, so she asked one of the Polish guys, journalists that were there, and he basically said, "Yeah, she choked you out," and she was like, "Yeah, she choked me out," and I cut the video there.
Oh, that's fantastic, man! All right, well, listen, I know you got to go. I don't want to keep you too long because you got to move along, and you got a long day ahead of you. So, did just want to say what's up. Obviously, your first full week as being a staff member. A salaried guy, not just a contributor. So thank you very much for the work and the sacrifices, and we appreciate what you're doing. And yeah, man, any last thoughts about this trip?
It's been a long trip, but it was fantastic. It was a fantastic event, and yeah, looking forward to the next one.
Fantastic. All right, well, as you go get packed up and as I refresh myself on some frosty beverages, what I wanted to let people listen to was a conversation I had with Mr. James Elliott, the man that now possesses the longest title in all of sports, basically like in all the world. He is the vice president and general manager of Europe, Middle East, and Africa.
Whoa.
Try fitting that on a business card. So, yeah.
Try fitting that on a lower thirds.
In a lower third. Yeah, that doesn't work so well. USC, VP, GM, EMA. Yeah. All right, so we're going to do that. I know you got to get out of here, so we'll usher you out the front door. I will re-up on a couple of frosty beverages, and everybody else can listen to my conversation with James Elliott as we just get an update on everything that's happening in Europe.
All right, keep watching the comeback.
Yeah, just relax. Good audio, yeah.
Hours on my hair as well.
I waste the that's time. Probably just a daily routine for you, right? The longest part of your day.
Yeah.
This, of course, the much anticipated follow-up to our Zagreb conversation, mm-hmm. which was well-received by everyone.
I think everyone enjoyed that.
It really did.
Everyone enjoyed it.
all right, let's talk about the Netherlands. First of all, another sellout. I think you said this is 5 straight sellouts for Europe.
Yep.
Seems like a very, very strong market right now. What do you think the key is? I mean, we see these ebbs and flows. You know, Canada obviously was like the epicenter of MMA for a while, and Brazil is doing amazing, and there's kind of ebbs and flows. But why do you think Europe is so strong right now?
I think it's, you know, we've got a great wave of fighters who are coming through, which obviously helps. You need local heroes, you need local stories, and I think we're beginning to find those, beginning to find that fighters begin to really resonate. Obviously, we've got Conor, we've got Alex Gustafsson, we've got Joanna Jędrzejczyk, with all these guys coming through who are really beginning to put European MMA on the map, and, you know, it kind of drags an entire continent with it. I think also, to be fair, it's got a lot to do with what Lorenzo and Dana and Frank Fertitta have done in terms of investing in the region and bringing big events here and putting the spotlight on, staffing up the office so that we can get around the 145 territories with more consistency and on a more regular basis. So all those things kind of combine to put us where we are today, but it's exciting times for the business, definitely.
It is, for sure. Talk about the Netherlands specifically, the market. It's a little bit of a, I guess you'd say, a delicate market, so to speak. I was surprised it took so long to get here. I mean, you think about the combat sports history here, but I guess they were a little resistant to mixed martial arts, so this is the first foray into it. What is the future? Is this kind of a, you know, dab your toe in the water a little bit, let them get used to it, or is this, you know, full steam ahead in the Netherlands? Where do we stand?
I think it's kind of halfway between the two, really. I think it's It has taken us a long time to come here. It's a market with a big combat sports heritage. You know, obviously, kickboxing is part of life here. So, you know, people kind of understand it. There was a bit of a misconception around what mixed martial arts is, what the events were going to be like, what the crowd was going to be like. So I think the fact that we've come here and it's been such a commercial success, such a big success for the Ahoy in Rotterdam, such a big success for the city, and the tickets went so quickly, I think it shows that this market's ready for it now, and I think people will see what we're about on Sunday night, and we're excited, and I see no reason why we won't be coming back.
Nice. We know now that we're going to Germany next, mm-hmm. A market that you guys have kind of remained committed to, even though I think there was a little, you know, tedious there as
bit
well.
A bit of a wave. You know, we're looking for that event. Obviously, we're shifting our focus. We've had a couple of events in Berlin in recent years. We've moved our focus over to Hamburg and the Barclays Arena over there. So that's where we want to be. And I think it's a big fight city. Hamburg is, you know, it's got a big boxing heritage. I know a couple of the promoters who do a lot of work there, so we're comfortable going there. I think it's right for us to try and explore new avenues. It's the biggest media market in mainland Europe, so it's something that's important for us. We've got a great partner there in ProSiebenSat.1, who are working with us to get mixed martial arts back onto mainstream TV. We've had our regulatory issues, which we're slowly working through. So it's a market we want to remain committed to, and we appreciate the support of all the fans out there, and hope they're going to turn out once again for us.
Nice. Sounds like you guys might be able to squeeze one more event in 2016.
Yeah, we're looking at it. We're definitely looking for something towards the back end, probably late November, I would say, early December, somewhere around there. We'd love to get one more event in. I'd love to get a few more events in, but they're not letting me squeeze them into the schedule just yet. But it's we'll look for an arena and for a date, and hopefully get that announced relatively soon.
Any hints where we might end up, or is it still to be determined?
Like I said before, you know, we're targeting the UK. We'd love to do another event in the UK, so we're just trying to figure out. It's difficult getting arenas at the moment and squeezing it into our schedule, which changes all the time.
Right.
So it's getting those planets to align can be a challenge sometimes, but we think we've just about done it. So we'll have news on that shortly.
We talked the last time. Nobody heard it, of course, but me and you. But France has kind of become your New York, you know, the one last bastion that needs to be taken care of. And I assume it's one of those things. You know, it's funny because Dana got to a point with New York where he just started saying, it's going to get done. I'm not sure when, but it's going to get done. Is that the case with France, or is it tougher than that? Where do we stand with that?
France is a tricky one. You know, it's I said before, once when New York was finally done, I called Lawrence Epstein and said congratulations, and his first question before he even answered that one was, when are we getting France sorted? So
right.
The focus of the business is now definitely on getting France done, but it's the same situation as we had with New York State. You know, it's about MMA. It's not about us, it's about this sport, and we want the sport to be properly recognized, the sport to be properly established within France, and everybody to have all the protections that being a recognized sport can bring. So we're looking for that. But like Dana said, I think it's going to happen. we're putting all our resources behind it. We're working with the authorities. You know, there's an investigation, sort of a report that's being done at the moment by the French government, and we're supporting in any way we can. And I think there's definitely
so it's kind of like a fact finding study
type. Yeah, they want to do doing their due diligence as you would expect. So we've offered our support to them in any way that we can, and we look forward to meeting with those guys and moving it forward. It definitely feels like there's more momentum now than there ever has been.
Very cool. I did want to ask you. You had a tragedy, obviously, in your market. Very important to note, of course, it wasn't the UFC.
Yep.
But there was a death in Ireland in mixed martial arts. It's just curious because I know it was a big story in Ireland, and of course, I mean, that's a hot spot for right now. Just what was your take on the situation? Is there anything the UFC can do in situations like this? Does it impact your business when people are concerned? I mean, obviously, these things can't happen in the sport, but
yeah.
But what was your take on it?
It's a similar situation to the work we're doing in France, to be honest. It's, you know, it's a line that Lorenzo's used. You know, we run towards regulation. This is why we're doing what we're doing around the world, you know, in terms of trying to bring best practice in, not just for ourselves, but for every other promotion, every gym, you know, and try and make people more aware of what they need to be doing. So what was, obviously it was a tragedy in our thoughts with the friends and family, but there's, what was interesting was that it led to calls for the sport to be regulated, and that's something that we definitely welcome, and it's something that we would like to see in every market, and it's something that we're actively offer our support in any way that we can to the Irish sports ministry and the Irish government. We want to make sure that we do everything in our power to look after the athletes at whatever level they're participating in, whether it's with UFC or with other promotions.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Ireland, Conor McGregor, it's been kind of an adventure. This guy is, I think he's definitely proven he's the biggest star in the sport. I mean, I think there used to be an argument, was it him or Ronda Rousey? Yeah. I think just the attention that he's drawn and everything that he's doing, he's proven that he's the biggest star in the sport. But I wonder, I mean, again, he's been fighting in Vegas, and you know, I know that it's tough for him to fight in Ireland, as a smaller venue and that sort of thing, but
We're still working on it.
He's still your guy at the end of the day. So when you see kind of what's going on, it seems like maybe there's some tension. I mean, everybody says, no, there is no tension. We're good. We'll all work together. But when you see your guy having this kind of like weird back and forth, what do? Is you watch it all unfold?
Well, we just do that, to be honest. We watch it all unfold, watch it all play out. You know, it's a shame that he's not on 200. Obviously, though, it's a big milestone for the sport and for the business. But you know, we're looking forward to, you know, DC Jones will be a good fight. You know, there's nothing going to be left outside with those guys. So, I think it's a shame, but you know, we've got commitments. There are things you have to do. You know, the promo has helped him get to where he's got now. The responsibilities, and you know, it's important part of the business. It's part of the job. So it's I understand where we're coming from, and I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But I'm sure he'll be back at some stage.
No doubt. All right. Well, of course, you're in charge of Europe, Middle East, and Africa. We've been talking about Europe a lot lately, but Middle East and Africa, I mean, what's going on there? Is there anything? I know it's, you know, not obviously as rich of markets and sort of busy, but are there things? I mean, are you guys making inroads in those locations?
Yeah, we're doing a lot of stuff in the Middle East. Obviously, we've got a good partner out there in Abu Dhabi Media. We're looking at some other things, obviously, across North Africa to expand our reach out there. Middle East is a big market. I was hoping to get there next year. We've got some interest from some places outside of Abu Dhabi, which could be interesting for us. So we're working through that at the minute. Some interesting venues and interesting proposals which we've received. And likewise, we've got a few meetings today in relation to trying to get something done in South Africa. The only reason we haven't gone there is because the currency is a challenge for us. It's just, you know, trying to make commercial sense for us is difficult. So we're definitely looking at it. You know, I've said before, we've got the Middle East is somewhere we've kind of been and then kind of away from and then come back to, and I think we'll definitely return. And for me, there are two big holes in my map, as it were, which is Russia and Africa, and we're working hard to get both of those sorted as well.
South Africa, I think, for people that don't know, and I'm sure what your studies show, it's actually a very passionate market,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
I mean, the MMA is big there.
Yeah, there's a local promotion called EFC who we know very well, who do a very good job down there and have kind of kept the fire burning whilst we've not been there. But we've got good TV partners now in Fox Sports, so we're back on TV. They're doing a lot to help promote us, and we'll try and figure out a way of getting down there. Definitely, it's somewhere we want to go. It's a beautiful part of the world, and it's an entire continent that we need to put our flag into. So we'll hopefully get that done as soon as we can find a way to make it make sense.
Very cool. You touched on Russia. Massive influx of Russian fighters, obviously, man. There's so much talent coming out of there. How realistic is a UFC event there? Is it becoming a reality?
We'd love to get one done. I think we've had a lot of conversations over the last sort of 12 to 18 months about how we can get it done in the most appropriate way. You know, it's not too hard to close your eyes and see an octagon in the middle of Red Square and people going crazy, you know. So it's there's a whole Rocky IV thing going on. So I think there's definitely something that we want to try and get done. You see, I don't know if you saw the reception Khabib got in the at the Reebok store.
That's a superstar.
Yeah. And you know, who knew, right? So it's the mall certainly didn't know that it was that big a star. So I think that's something that we can capitalize on and something that we can use. It's a big market for us. We're on free to air TV there. We've got great partners in Match TV. So it's a big market for us and one that's kind of just sat there waiting for us to do something with it. But five or six events a year, 145 territories. It's tough to keep everyone happy.
We'll talk about 2017. I know you guys are probably deep into the planning for that. You guys obviously have to be forward thinking. So personal goals, new markets. I mean, as you look at that, does it look the volume of events stay about the same? I mean, what do you see for 2017?
I would personally like to see a couple more events in Europe. I think the markets, the business is justifies it. You know, five consecutive sellouts. We'll have six when we sell Hamburg out. I'll keep pressure in the team. That's what we're going to deliver. So, and I'm sure when we come back to the UK, we'll have success there as well. So it's, you know, the market's ripe, like you said at the start. You know, this is something I want to continue to develop, and certainly the team here are very excited about what we can do. I'd love to see a blend of a couple of new territories and returning to see some, you know, some places that we've been and been well received before. So a couple of bankers and a couple of rolls of the dice, I think, is called for next year.
Nice. Awesome, brother. Well, I always appreciate the insight. Any other last thoughts, messages, anything like that that you want to make sure that our fans know about?
No, I think it's just thanks for continuing to support us. You know, I keep saying it because it's true. You know, we do listen, you know, and, you know, Rotterdam and the Netherlands in particular, we're calling for an event for a long time. Took us a long time to get here. We listened. We heard it. Took us a while to get something done about it, but now we're here. Same thing with Croatia. You know, we talked about that for a long time. Great market. Took us a long time. We went there. Commercial success. So we can't keep breaking these new markets if we don't have the support of the fans, and the fans turn out. They see the reception that JDS got in Zagreb. You know, you were there. You heard it. It was, you know, it's the hairs stand up on the back of your neck. And that's the beauty of this sport, is the fact that there's a Brazilian fighter fighting in Croatia, and he gets a standing ovation when he walks out. Who
awesome.
Knew? This is a global sport, so it's, you know, we need to get around to as many different places as we can.
Very cool. Awesome, brother. Thank you, man. I always appreciate the updates, man.
Well, that was Mr. James Elliott, the man with the most complicated title in all sports, the vice president and general manager of Europe, Middle East, and Africa. But a guy that's doing very well right now. 5 consecutive sellouts, I believe, is what they've accomplished in the UK market. And things are going very well for him. Hamburg, Germany is up next. We'll see what happens there. Bringing back my man Mike Bond for the final leg of this little journey. And what better way to end a road show than actually on the road. We are currently in the back of a very nice car, by the way. I probably shouldn't say that we're in the back of a Mercedes, but, you know, it's how we roll.
I mean, I think that's the standard pickup here for a nice ride home to the airport.
Just saying. We have to go back to Amsterdam, a much larger airport in Amsterdam than Rotterdam, so that's why we're heading back. You look at this card, and we've talked a lot about it. I did want to ask you about a couple things that we haven't touched on yet. First of all, the fact that this stoppage in the main event, or excuse me, the co-main event with Stefan Struve and Antonio Silva, I know you're the stat guy.
Yeah.
We're going with 16 seconds, right? That's after much hand-wringing and research and discussion, we're going with 16 seconds.
It's 16 seconds, and I believe that's the third fastest knockout in heavyweight history. So good on Stefan Struve. He's in the record books. I think he was, you know, he's been on the end of some pretty quick ones, specifically his first UFC loss when Junior Dos Santos, you know, put him away pretty quick, way right. back at UFC, you know, 90 or 80 something, just way, way, way back in the day. And yeah, it was interesting to see him get one on the other end. I mean, like I said, coming into the event, I thought Struve looked physically better than we've ever seen him.
Sure.
It translated in the cage, and you know, it's hard to gauge too much of it because, you know, Simon Head spoke a bit on Bigfoot earlier. Like, I don't know. I worry about that guy. It's a lot of damage, man. It's all those, and they get shorter and shorter. You know, Mark Hunt put him away pretty quick last time.
Sure.
This one was, you know, 15 seconds, and as you mentioned, 16. It looked like he barely even got hit that bad. You know, Struve hit him with some big elbows
yep.
after he was
of
down,
course,
but
yeah.
like the shot that sent him down didn't really seem like anything from where we were sitting, and even from the replay, it looked kind of weird. And I don't know, I just, Simon kind of said earlier, you don't want to be the guy who, like, forces someone into retirement, but, you know, the UFC sent us out the post-fight quotes, and he basically said, you know, I'll be back. So, I don't know, like, should he even be in the UFC anymore? How many guys get to stick around who are who are 1-6-1 in their fights?
I think we'll let him go. I think
so like, you know, if they want to, if he wants,
what, a Bellator or a World Series of Fighting, something like that.
Dude, the thing is, those companies. I mean, I think World Series would reach out because, you know, we've had conversations about how World Series is trying to build the heavyweight division.
Yeah, Ray Sefo was intent on building a heavyweight
division. So I could see that doing. I don't know how interested Bellator would be, maybe, you know, depending on the price, but I think his time in the UFC should, you know, definitely be done. He clearly, you know, Struve was a pretty reasonable step down considering some of the guys he's faced. Like
maybe even one. I mean, he's definitely I mean, not to be rude or whatever, but he's definitely the definition of kind of like that freak show matchup, right? I mean, like, anything you put him in is it's wild, right?
Yeah, and yeah, I just don't know anymore. Like, I'm not comfortable with it. I very rarely say this, like, you know, a guy should walk away, but it's sad to see where the guy who, you know, beat up Fedor to come to this point. And it's the fight game, and this thing is relentless. It chews you up and spits you out. Doesn't matter who you are or what you've accomplished if you stick around too long. And I just don't want to see it in the UFC anymore. I would hope that maybe for a guy like him who's been so intent on fighting at the highest level forever, if he did get let go by the UFC, maybe he would see that as a sign that, you know, maybe I should look at other things. But for a guy like him who does have that Fedor win, dude, like, you're telling me if he got cut, Rizin wouldn't pick him up and try to book a rematch with Fedor, who they have? Like, that's something that I could definitely see happening. There'll be people who will be willing to give him fights in the event he gets let go, and maybe that's why the UFC's kept him for this long. They could have let him go a little while ago, and granted, he's been fighting very good fighters. Like, you know, Struve was, I mean, the one win he has is Soa Pelele, who's no longer with the company, is retired, and I don't know. It's just, I don't want to see it anymore in the UFC. If he gets let go and decides that he wants to continue fighting, that's on him. I would hope, you know, we know his manager's Alex Davis, who's someone we've spoke with on this podcast before, who, you know, I consider a very good guy. I would hope the people around him more than anything, because we say this all the time about the fighters, like, they're not going to, it takes a lot of things to make these guys, like, actually walk away, and it's a lot of the time it's about the people around you. So I would hope he has the necessary people around him that at this point would make him, you know, or at least make him think about it.
For sure. Let's talk about a big main card fight, Gunnar Nelson defeating Albert Tumanoff. John Kavanaugh was happy to look over at me after that performance and say, "You picked the wrong guy, dude." Yeah. And I did, man.
I looked down because I picked Tumanoff too, and I picked the other guy. I was like, "Yeah,
dude, Gunnar Nelson." It was funny because I, you know, if I'd have known that guy was going to show up tonight, I mean, what an incredible version of Gunnar Nelson that is. I don't know what the difference was, but I just thought that everything he did looked on point. I mean, even in the striking, which you knew was playing a dangerous game, you didn't want to stand there and strike too long. But he was having some success in there, and he looked really fast, and he looked really just comfortable. And then, of course, you know, on the ground, he's definitely a monster. But I think that might have been the best we've ever seen him look.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think we even said on, you know, the pre-fight podcast, very high on Tumanov, even going back to that date. And, you know, maybe he is the best striker in the UFC, but doesn't mean anything if you can't stop a takedown or you can't do anything. And we saw, you know, his first UFC fight was a loss, a split decision to Ildemar Alcantara, who's not even the better Alcantara out of the two brothers.
Wow.
The lead, you know, I'm just saying it. You know, Yuri has been much more successful in his career.
Sure.
And, yeah, I don't know. We saw some things there. Like, personally, watching that fight, I didn't think, I could see an argument for Tumanov winning that one, so he could have come into this thing 6-0 in the UFC. But we saw some flaws in that fight, and maybe you just think maybe it was the matchups he's been getting of late. He didn't really go with anyone that was going to do what Gunnar was trying to do to him tonight, consistently, you know, pressure him and go for the takedown and work in strikes and just throw the whole game at him. He's fighting guys like Lorenz Larkin, who are, you know, basically stand-up fighters. Will maybe shoot for a takedown if they get in trouble or something, but that's not their primary tactic. So maybe got, you know, I think maybe I'll admit I did. I probably got too caught up in the, you know, best striker game, and he got a little bit exposed tonight. I mean, he's a young guy, Albert Tumanov. I think he's still only 24 years old.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah, dude, like, he's got so much room to grow. Maybe this just wasn't what was meant for him at this time. Maybe he needed the setback to realize that the growth is still there. But on to Gunnar, I mean, he looked absolutely unbelievable. He goes in there, not many people are going to be able to mess with that guy on the ground. It just makes you appreciate Damian Maia to a whole nother level,
absolutely,
dude. Like, when you see guys go in there, even when you see, like, Neil Magny go in there and, like, have his way with someone like Kelvin Gastelum on the ground, you're like, oh, holy crap, you know, like, Damian Maia is just next level. It's unbelievable. So the fact that it just makes Maya look better.
It
these
does.
Wins when these guys he's like completely owning.
It really
like
does.
Shutting out on the scorecards, go in and beat like high level guys. So props to Damian Maya. Very much looking forward to his fight with Matt Brown at UFC 198. That's gonna be very interesting. But God, like if Matt Brown can't keep it off the ground, that's
he's
big trouble.
Be in
trouble. But not to change topics too much. On to Garren Nelson. You know, I don't know. It's hard to say because he said that Damian Maya fight, he's like, that was one of those nights where I showed up and I just legitimately didn't, like, feel like I was myself. I felt like I was, you know, not on point and all this stuff. And I don't know. It's weird. They all learn, they grow. But, yeah, he looked great tonight or on Sunday.
Yeah.
Whatever.
At this point, it's 7 o'clock in the morning as we're still on our way.
Right,
we haven't been to sleep yet, so it's still –
sure.
This morning, last night.
Sure. So either way, he looked great and a huge win for him to get on back on track. And I think he's going to be, you know, he'll be hanging around the top of this division for a while. Like, there's many, many guys you could book him against that would be very fun, interesting fights.
Yep. Nikita Krylov, as we learned this week, not Krylov, who is no longer Al Capone, the Miner. I don't know what that's about.
Yeah,
I wish you'd kind of go back to Al Capone. But I feel like this guy was kind of like,
A joke at first, yeah.
You know what I mean? But like, all of a sudden, are we looking at a legitimate dude? Because I'm telling you, he's starting to look better and better. Now I'm thinking it was just a joke at first. Now we might have ourselves a guy.
It's weird, and everyone painted him a joke because of that. Just that fight he had with Soa Pulele.
Right.
Back when he was fighting at heavyweight, which is crazy to think about now. Like that dude was fighting at heavyweight. He was like, I just wonder, was he just so lazy? Like, was it one of those things the UFC is like, Joseph Silva's like, come on, dude. Like, what are you doing fighting like 250-pound guys? And that was probably a fight. You know, they put him against like, Soa Pulele cuts to 265.
Right.
He is a large man. So they're like, that, and that's, you know, something.
We'll teach you a little something.
Seems
here,
like
sir.
Joe Silva's one of his kind of tricks. They're, you know, we're going to book you against, like, even someone like Garren Nelson to go back to that. Like, you know, a lot of people said Garren Nelson would be at his best at 155.
Right.
He's a little small. So we're going to book you against the, like, a former 185er Damian Maya, who's, like, a beast. They play a little tricks like that, you know. So I can understand. Maybe that's what made him go down. He won that fight, but it was just absolutely awful. And the fact that kind of put that image on Krylov is like, this guy, he just had one of the worst fights of the year.
Yep.
Everyone's like, okay, who is this guy? You go to his Sherdog profile, and it's like, you know, him wearing the Al Capone outfit. He's got
hilarious.
The UFC gloves. And this was even before he got in the UFC.
Yeah.
That picture was taken. He's wearing the gloves. He's got the hat. I've talked to people at Sherdog. They said forever he was like the most clicked Sherdog fight finder just because of his photo.
That's hilarious.
And it's ridiculous. So he goes, you know, he had his little gimmick and everyone just, you know, thought he was a joke, but he's now going in there. He's, you know, I don't know how many people in MMA have got 20 wins and finished every single one.
That's
of them.
Insane.
It's pretty crazy. And he's finishing every fight in the UFC. He's not fighting world beaters at this point, but you know, he's going in there. He's submitting a jiu-jitsu black belt, you know, not even just like, and it was weird, you know, but like people are saying Barroso gave up and everything, but he forced him to do that. He was
something
beating
happened.
Him up.
Dude, yes, because the choke wasn't all the way under the neck. It
no.
was more of a crank almost, you know.
Yeah.
But
so
he got
it was
done.
Weird. But yeah, so he keeps winning. He has 4-0. I mean, like, he has the second longest winning streak in the light heavyweight division behind Jon Jones.
That's insane.
When you told me, like, Nikita Krylov and Jon Jones
would be mentioned together,
are belong in the same sentence together. It might just be under this one specific context.
Still there.
But they are being placed. The UFC, we were sitting cage side, so I didn't see the graphic, but I imagine they put up the graphic of longest winning streaks in the light heavyweight division. Like, they always do that.
Sure.
So maybe if I'm wrong, someone, you know, whatever, tweet me or something. But I assume that happened. And it's, you know, you see that same context. So good for him, man. He's still, I think he's only 23. He's very young. As we mentioned, like, in Albert Tumanov, he's had a few setbacks. But who knows, man? Like, just keep building him up. You don't need to rush him in there. But he's clearly, you know, got some skill, got killer instinct. Who knows, man? The interesting things could happen with this guy who is now proving, like, he has a place in the UFC. He's earned his spot. So people thought that fight was a joke. I thought it was a joke. It was an awful fight with Pulele, but he is winning fights, you know, at a more frequent weight than pretty much everyone at light heavyweight. So you know, you can't hate on this man any longer. Oscar. Give Al Capone, the miner,
the miner,
his props.
Just make him change his nickname back. It's funny.
I mean, can we go back and say, is he the first guy in UFC history to be have two different nicknames announced by Buffer in one fight? He might very well be. He was introduced as Al Capone and declared the winner as the miner. So
he changed mid-fight. He changed it. That's awesome. A couple big performances on the prelims. Rustam Khabilov, and Magnus Seidenblad. Rustam, a fun fight with Chris Wade. Obviously, thought he damn near got knocked out and somehow just recovering that immediately. And then, of course, Magnus Seidenblad, your self-declared most fun interview of the week because he is a fun dude. He came out and basically told us he was going to be in beast mode, and as far as I'm concerned, delivered.
Yeah, he put the hurt in. He did really well, man. And another guy, you know, think about there, winning streaks at middleweight. He's in the same sentence, third longest behind Yoel Romero and Luke Rockhold. He's right there. It's weird things. And the thing, you know, Seidenblad clearly has skills. More than anything, the only thing holding him back is, you know, himself and the injuries.
Right.
He's fought, you know, one time a year for the past 3 or 4 years. And he kind of said as much, you know. He just needs to get the ball rolling. He has the skill. He seems like he's as confident as anyone you'll talk to. You know, I hear many guys who are fighting on the prelims, like he, when we were talking in our interview, he himself brought up Chris Weidman, Luke Rockhold.
That's right,
said. He said,
I'm
you know,
not going to beat those top-tier guys unless I'm, you know, doing these things.
Exactly.
That's amazing when you're at that level, but you're thinking, that's where I want
to
be.
Yeah, and, you know, and people will be reluctant to say those kind of things. You might have to, you know, you'll bring up an interview, oh, how far away are you from a title shot? And maybe they'll say it, but you ask him a basic question. He has an agenda. He, you know, he knew what he wanted to say in that interview in his mind. He got his thoughts out there, and, you know, he backed it up as well as anyone. And good for him. We saw him later in the broadcast chilling with Gustafson cage side, having a beer. He earned it from what I saw. Like, that was a great win for him. 4 in a row now, and just pretty much on this guy. If he can stay healthy, I'd hope Joe Silva will book him again soon, and we can see him, you know, fight some more established competition, because, you know, Gareth McClellan, I've been butchering this guy's name all week, everyone. But McClellan, the fighters out of South Africa aren't particularly established. They've had a bit of a rocky road in the UFC, so I wasn't surprised it went that way. But, yeah, let's get Seidenblad in there against someone who is a little more established in that division.
He's got a unique body frame, man. The size that he has, dude, you can't teach that kind of size. Yep. And it looks like he's trying to develop everything. So definitely was a big win for him. Well, anything else that stood out to you, man? Anything that's just burning that you're like, man, if people didn't watch this show, this is what they need to know about?
I mean, I don't think there's anything crazy, but not everyone subscribes to Fight Pass.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, you miss the Horiguchi fight. Kyoji Horiguchi, you know, he's looking good. And Neil Siri, like, that guy, you know, probably one of the most, like, I don't know if underrated, but for a 16-12 record, like, he's a lot better than his record shows, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And he goes out there, he gets dropped with basically like the first punch of the fight.
Yeah.
And he hangs in there the whole 3 rounds. He continues to come forward. He pushes Horiguchi, even bloodied him up, seemed to have some momentum on his side at points throughout that fight. But it just, you know, there's a reason Horiguchi was the biggest favorite on the card, like minus 600 or something. And I don't think there's many people picking Neil Siri, but he went in there.
I thought the odds were skewed, though. Yeah. I thought the odds were skewed. I thought my 600 was too much. And then you watch the fight play out, and you're like, oh, never mind. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah, like I thought Horiguchi was going to win, so like no matter what. So if you could put whatever odds on there, I was picking Horiguchi. Like, there was nothing that would tempt me into picking Siri. But he's looking great, man. He lost that fight to Demetrius. He's going to be probably forever in UFC history, because that record can't be beaten of the latest submission, 459
right.
round 5
right.
Like, I don't know if there's any other way to do it, unless like someone gets knocked out at the buzzer or whatever, just something late. It's gonna be the latest stoppage in title fight history. But he is he's a very good talent. He's the most successful fighter, you know, probably out of Japan to be in the UFC. I know there's some guys back in the day, but like modern era for sure.
Definitely at the moment.
Yeah, like, you know, Yushin Okami
yep.
was there. But don't know, Horiguchi, he just seems to have a lot more going for him. He's a lot more exciting than Yushin. Yushin always got the hate because he just wasn't exciting at all, and he had that style. But, you know, Horiguchi's kind of the opposite. He'll strike with you, he'll grapple with you, and he's a fun guy. I mean, you can tell it's funny now. I remember I watched his post-fight scrum. He used to be a guy completely oblivious to English, but now, like, you know, you can tell he's not comfortable enough to speak it. But during the scrum, people would ask a question, and he'd be like, yep. Like, he'd be shaking his head, like, he'd maybe say a word there, but he's getting more comfortable, and he got rushed into that fight with Demetrius Johnson just because of the nature of the flyweight division. He should have had a few more fights. He said specifically he wasn't ready for the title shot, and then when he got it, of course, he, you know, was trying to be confident, but he's a guy I'd be interested to see. You know, he said he wants to fight Demetrius again as soon as possible. I don't want to see that. Give him 3, 4, 5 more fights. Give him, like, the Joseph Benavidez treatment. If you need, like, build this guy up, let him keep developing under this new team, and I'd really like to see what he does when he's, like, you know, 27, 28, if Demetrius is still holding the title, if he's even in that division still. Who knows what will happen, but that's a guy, you know, as long as the flyweight division is around, he's a member of that weight class, he'll be at the top. So really impressed with him tonight. And, you know, Neil Siri as well. Unfortunate for the Irish, they haven't won a fight in the UFC since Conor McGregor knocked out Jose Aldo.
Wow.
So there hasn't been a ton of them fighting, but, you know, Duffy lost, Conor lost, it's Neil lost. It's been a rough stretch for them. So I don't know. So I don't mean to end the podcast by, like, shitting on the Irish.
Nah, it's so wild. It's been a rough stretch. That's how things can change. Hey, man. You're a Canadian dude. You're from the former Mecca of mixed martial arts.
Yeah,
which, you know,
being there, you know, you go in there, you have your superstar, and things change real quick in the sport. As we see, it's the markets. It takes one guy losing. It takes who knows. And the Irish market was always kind of in a spot because once Conor got too big for them, they, you know, it kind of got into a bad spot. They weren't going to get him fighting there. But either way, you know, I'm sure they'll get back on track. Conor will fight again, and he might win, and
who knows? All will be right in the world.
All will be right with the world. It's all good.
Awesome, man. Well, as you said, it is time to wrap things up. We are just a few minutes away from the airport, at which point I think both of us are ready to just jump on a plane and fall asleep because I'm exhausted.
Yes.
It's been a fun week.
On to Curitiba.
We are now on to Curitiba for UFC 198. I'm super pumped about that. It's a stadium show, which is always a little bit different. Never been to Curitiba.
That card is so good.
And the card
is so good. It's so good. Every fight, there's interesting things. You know, could be the last time you're seeing Anderson Silva fight. If that
Shogun,
doesn't go his way,
maybe.
Shogun, Lil Nog. You know, you got ridiculous barn burners like Rob Font and John Lineker early on the card. You got Cyborg's debut. You got Vitor and Yagare, which no one is talking about. That's a huge fight at 185. You know, that's a huge fight for Vitor in particular. You know, he's getting – his whole thing is being his ground game, especially, you know, after the Weidman fight. Like, everyone was like, what is going on here? Like, it seemed like he had nothing on the ground. You know, if Yagare takes him down, submits him right away, maybe that's the end of Vitor as a relevant middleweight. Vitor goes in.
Or he'd maybe get a title shot.
Yeah, dude. And Vitor goes in, and if he wins, God, this man is at 20-plus years of fighting in the UFC. What a beast.
That is absolutely amazing. I am looking forward to it, too. We're going to have full coverage all week long. Of course, you're traveling back to Canada in between. I'm traveling back to Las Vegas in between. And then we will hit the ground running on Wednesday morning. Our man Cole Coffey will be back in business. He'll be there as well. Our new addition to the team, Fernando Praches, will also be part of the coverage as well. So it should be a fun week. Definitely looking forward to that. In the meantime, we'll put Rotterdam in the rear view, especially since we have Amsterdam and technically right in front of us. And thanks for listening.